Hey, 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 and welcome to Expanded Perspectives from the Archives, revisiting the conversations that help shape the show. This is a new show. It's a spinoff of the original show, and I'll explain why we're doing this. You see, when Cam and I first started back in 2012, well, we didn't know what we were doing, and so we relied heavily on our guests to do most of the heavy lifting. And so we got a deal with a book publisher, two or three actually. What they would do is they would send us the books, we would read the books, and then they would send us the contact information to the actual authors, who then we would schedule to come on the show. And that's kind of the way it worked for the first 2 or 3 years. And then slowly over time, we started doing less and less interviews as we learned what we were doing and found our way. And today, we virtually don't do interviews at all. I mean, it's very rare that we do any interviews. And it's not because of lack of people trying to get on the show. Every day, we probably get 4 to 6 requests for people to have come on the show. And some of them are really crazy because it's like they don't even seem to know what our show's about. I think they probably just go on like iTunes and pull up the top charts and they just email everybody that's in the top 100 for their category. Because I'll get somebody on and be like, oh, what's in what's face? You know, wrote a number one book on how to triple your crypto in your crypto wallet. And I'm like, crypto wallet? Do you even listen to the show? We talk about cryptids, not crypto. But anyways, yeah, so what I'm going to do is go back to some of the classic interviews we did back in the day, because we had a lot of interviews. And yeah, they're old, and the audio wasn't as good, and Cam and I, of course, didn't know what we were doing, but we still had genuine conversations, interesting conversations. And so that's what we're going to do. Like once a week, maybe once every other week, I'm going to be releasing one where we go back and cover some of those old, interesting conversations. And it's going to be called Expanded Perspectives from the Archives, Revisiting the Conversations That Help Shape the Show. In this first episode, we're going to be talking with Rick Osman. He wrote a book called Graves of the Golden Bear, Ancient Monuments and Fortresses of the Ohio Valley. It was published in 2011, so it was pretty new when we had him on. And we get into some really cool topics, including proof that the Romans were here far, far before Christopher Columbus. Let's get into that interview. Enjoy.
All right, guys. Well, we have got another great treat for everybody tonight. We have the great Mr. Rick Osman on. Rick, how are you doing?
Oh, I was much better, but I got over it.
I understand. We were talking off air. It got a little chilly up there with you there, and you're in Indiana, yeah, correct?
I am, southern Indiana, and pretty much the same temperature is across the entire state. Earlier today, it was 17 above, and it's on its way to 14 or so above as an overnight low. And it's okay until I have to go feed the horses.
You're having a heat wave now. You're going to have to go there in a t-shirt if it gets up above 17.
Oh, I got a t-shirt and a few other layers.
That's right.
But I don't think the, since we're here to talk about history, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, sir.
I don't think this is much different than it was when the pioneers were out here in the late 1700s, early 1800s.
Yeah, you're probably right. They just, they're way tougher than I was.
Yeah, any of us, I think. George Rogers Clark, General George Rogers Clark, the guy who captured Sackville from the English in 1781. He waded through 3 miles of frozen floodwater. Okay, it wasn't completely frozen or he wouldn't have been wading, but up to his waist through floodwaters in February to capture that fort. And he never walked right afterwards. He still served, but he didn't walk right. It ruined him forever, and he never got paid for that foray.
Oh, yeah, that's a hell of a man.
The Commonwealth of Virginia kind of screwed him over on his expenses. And in 1912, all of his receipts came to light in the Capitol in Richmond.
Wow. So the government was sticking it to the man even back then.
Yeah, pretty much. And that war would have been lost without his actions, too.
Man, that's a very driven individual willing to do that.
I agree.
Man. Well, Rick, we have kept up with a lot of your work over the years and listened to tons of interviews, read a lot of your articles and things like that. And there's a few things we'd like to just talk to you about tonight.
Okay. Shoot.
I would like for you to explain to the audience and to us about the, we've had a lot of different pre-Columbian and a lot of ancient history guys on. I really am fascinated with the fact that the Romans visited North America in pre-Columbian history. Can you enlighten us some more on that?
Yeah, let's go with there is strong evidence indicating the Romans were here. To say definitively if they were here, I don't know until I find it in a Roman history somewhere.
Gotcha.
And I don't think that's going to happen because I think it was a secret mission. I think it happened. The evidence, you know, there are hundreds. Before I wrote the book, I knew of a couple hundred different Roman coin finds. I should say a couple hundred coins in various finds. Anywhere from one to about 52 was the largest cache I knew of at that time. I recently found out about another cache, this one actually west of the Rockies, the first such cache west of the Rockies, and it has 386 in it.
Wow.
This isn't some coin collector at this point, not when you get into large batches of them. Mm. You know, a guy losing his lucky coin fishing, maybe once, twice, but does every fisherman carry a Roman coin as his lucky coin? I think not.
Yeah.
And those that do are usually pretty fastidious about all of their equipment, and that would certainly be one important part of their equipment if it was their lucky coin. But they're found by children, chickens, and if you read Gloria Farley's work, you know that she really had a very clever and concise rejoinder to they're not found under controlled conditions. And she essentially said, they're not lost under controlled conditions. So, you know, how do you, okay, I'm going to go dig up a coin. Really? Where? How do you know it's there?
Yeah.
No, you don't. You run across them. And the metal detectorists are finding them. And they're just, to them, unless it's in exceptionally good condition, it's just a little bit of metal. Because all the faces or whatever are worn off or eroded off, corroded off. Occasionally they find one that's pretty much pristine. Brad Sutherland up in Wisconsin found a Byzantine coin, 8th, 9th century, and it was still legible completely.
Wow.
And it doesn't belong there either, but it's not a Roman coin. The Romans, and more importantly, it's dated. We know when those coins were made. And for the most part, we know where they were made because each place that they were struck had its own little idiosyncrasies of how the coin turned out as a finished product. There are a few, just a half a dozen or so, that would fall in the category of what they call a provincial strike or emergency coinage, where Rome couldn't get enough metal out to the provinces for coinage to pay bills and whatnot, so that it would either melt down the former realm's coins and sheet them, or they would just restrike them into a Roman coin. The restrikes are very, very, very rare and pretty much priceless, and I probably would not carry one in my pocket to go fishing. But there are examples of, you know, 300 years, 400 years of Roman coins, give or take, that are found throughout the greater Ohio Valley, Ohio and Mississippi Valley, as well as up and down the coasts. But there, up until this find in Utah, none of them had been west of the Rockies. And all of them still are near waterways because the waterways were the highways. Now, the Roman presence began in earnest was sometime between 117 AD and 142 AD. And I believe it probably continued up into the early to mid 4th century for a lot of reasons that we simply don't have time to go into. That's apparently the period of occupation. There are also other technologies besides coins and other artifacts besides coins that seem to indicate a Roman use of technology, even if it wasn't Romans using the technology. It was Roman technology. There's concrete. They were the best in the world for 1,000 years. And in some regards, they're still the best in the world with concrete.
Mm-hmm.
Their warfare techniques and technologies were an accumulation of everyone they ever fought, plus a few that they didn't. And they would steal, borrow, buy, coerce anybody's technologies of any kind, warfare or otherwise, into their own system. And when they conquered someone, they would say, okay, here's the deal. You pay tribute, and we will sit down with you to write out the laws of your land in such a way that, hey, if you got a king, that's cool, as long as that king pays tribute to Rome. And in exchange, we will stay here and be your army. Well, that worked out a lot of the places it went, not so much Germania. And there's no history, written history, that, okay, definitely says we, the Romans, were in North America. But there are a lot of accounts in, say, family histories, particularly in merchant families, of a trip that certainly sounds like it was North America. And these were not Rome itself, but they were outliers. But they were important people within the Roman Empire because they were rich. Now, why 117? Because that's when the 9th Roman Legion disappears from history. The 9th Roman Legion was created in Hispania, in Western Hispania, which was now Portugal, as an occupation by Scipio in, 62 BC, and later by Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar took the 9th to Mesopotamia and Macedonia and Macedonia and Gaul and Britain twice, and who knows where else. He retired them into Hispania again, then called them up again for Gaul. And in that campaign with Gaul and Germania, they build a bridge across the Rhine River. Now, this river is sizable, substantial, and swift in the right conditions. But they build a bridge across that river in 10 days and marched across it and found no one to fight. So they retreated back across, no, they advanced backwards across the Rhine and took up the bridge as they went. Then 2 years later, the Germanians are getting feisty again. They build another bridge in a different spot, and this time they did it in 4 days, and they had a little fight that convinced them for a while, for 400 years, give or take, that they could not beat the Romans.
How in the world did they build a bridge over the Rhine in 4 days? I mean, the Rhine's a pretty big river.
Well, they had three legions. That comes to about 16,500 troops.
Wow.
Three out of four troops carried an axe. And they probably denuded the entire forest around wherever they built that bridge. That's why they didn't build the same bridge in the same place after just 2 years.
And then no supplies.
No treats. Right.
Yeah, but not just the manpower. I mean, they must have really known what they were doing to even, to orchestrate the building of a bridge in 4 days.
And it was basically a prefab. Each and every Roman soldier had to know how to read and write, and preferably in more than one language and more than one script. We can get back to that one in a little bit. But yeah, and today, the United States Army says that you have to pass a 9th grade reading test in order to have a high school diploma now, but you only have to pass a 9th grade reading test. And they're having trouble with that, which is bizarre.
Yes.
But the Romans, they called them Marius's mules on the soldiers, and they had a kit. Everything was pre-planned, and this set of troops, 4 or 8 in a squad, depending on the nature of the squad, had this set of equipment, and everybody knew what everybody else was supposed to do as well as their own, and they could trade jobs, whatnot, as long as the job got done. And everything was prefab. The bridges, they'd go out and say, okay, I need 482 trees this diameter, this length, with this kind of notch in it. And they'd go do it. And they'd build fortresses the same way. It was prefab. They had a plan before they ever left wherever they left from, and all they had to do was gather up the resources, and in a few days they would have this giant construction, and it would work. In what we call York today, in Yorkshire, England, they built a fortress in 78-79 AD, basically after getting their ass handed to them by a woman. And later they conquered her, not militarily, but by espionage and subterfuge, and captured her daughters. And they were kind of nefarious that way.
They were the war machine. When people talk about the Roman war machine, it was true that they could just steamroll over whatever they felt like going to.
Well, yes, there were some exceptions.
Yes, of course, but
they you know, the victors write the history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go back to Julius Caesar for a moment. The first time he visited Britain, of course, he was on a ship, and within 3 days, the Brits, or Brutes as he called them, raised 700 ships against his fleet, and he escaped with his life. Therefore, he was victorious.
All right, guys, let's take a break to do an ad, and then we'll get right back in to that amazing interview. All right, guys, I want to talk to all the men listening for a second. I'll be turning 50 this August, and I've realized my body doesn't work the way it did in my 20s. I can still work out, try to eat right, but that stubborn belly fat, it hangs on, and by the afternoon, my energy is usually running on empty. The truth is, as we get older, our testosterone naturally starts to decline. That can make it easier to gain weight, lose muscle, and just not feel like yourself anymore. That's why I started taking Mars Men. It's a natural testosterone support stack with ingredients like Kongjat, Ali, Shilajit, zinc, and boron. No injections, no synthetic hormones, and no crazy stimulants. Just ingredients designed to help support your body's natural testosterone production. And the best part, it's made right here in the USA. It's third-party tested and backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. Plus, more than 91% of users report higher energy levels. I've noticed better energy throughout the day, stronger workouts, and better recovery, and that's a win-win in my book. Right now, our listeners can get 50% off for life, plus free shipping and 3 free gifts by visiting mengotomars.com. That's mengotomars.com. And after your order, they'll ask how you heard about them. Please let them know you heard about them on Expanded Perspectives. It really helps out the show. mengotomars.com.
And in fact, he did lose some ships.
That's not what he wrote in the books, though, was it?
No, they weren't ships that were important to him. Therefore, he didn't care.
Yeah.
And when Claudius invaded, this is where it starts getting really interesting. When Claudius invaded, and that's a misnomer, when Claudius went to Europe, to Britain, and finally figured out that he wasn't going to control much of a population with the troops he had, he sent word back to Rome for another full legion to join him as soon as possible, which they actually came out of Gaul, so it was only a couple of days. What? It was only a couple of days before they got there. Yes, that's true. The message that Claudius sent from Britain arrived on the same date in Rome, and the next day those troops were dispatched from basically Normandy. It's like, wow, that's a long way from
that's impressive. That's impressive.
Yeah, it is impressive, but it was a line of sight communications network that they set up wherever they went, which, you know, if you look at the map of the Roman Empire, that was pretty much everywhere in the known world to them.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about the Ninth Legion, that they just up and vanished.
Yes.
Now, what year did they just quit being in the history books, that they vanished?
117.
And they just, and that's who you believe came over here?
That's the very first year of the reign of Hadrian. And I'm sure they didn't kill them off. I'm sure they didn't die in battle. I'm sure they didn't absorb them into other legions, because that would be recorded somewhere.
Yes.
Right.
I think they were dispatched on some kind of a secret mission, because Rome was kind of on the ropes as far as resources at that point. Even though Trajan, which was Hadrian's predecessor, had captured new territories, it had not been as lucrative as Rome had hoped. So Hadrian was kind of in a world of hurt to gather up, you know, some wealth, some fortune from some place in a hurry to satisfy the Roman citizens and the Senate to make sure that he could remain in power, which he did until 138. So what, 18 more years? Something like that. 19 more years. And he built a wall across Britain. You know, Hadrian's Wall. You know, mm-hmm. About Hadrian's Wall, right? Okay, from the Firth of Forth to the almost to the Island of Man. It mm-hmm. didn't stop at the sea. the Irish Sea. But anyway, it's 78 miles long, I think it is, 72 miles long. And it has multiple gates, and it has mile castles. Every Roman mile, there's this little turret, basically, that was manned. And there were fort castles that were capable of about 500 troops housing. But it wasn't really a military installation. It was a toll booth that went all the way across Britain. And it kept the Picts, didn't keep them out. It just kept them in some modicum of economic control. They couldn't trade with Lower Britain without paying tribute to Rome. And that's what I think Hadrian was after, was controlling trade. And certainly in at the other end of the Roman Empire, in Arabia Petraeus, that was the one new acquisition that Trajan had made as far as territories that Hadrian kept. The rest of them he gave back. Said, this isn't worth keeping. But he kept Arabia Petraeus, what we know today as the city of Petra. You know, the facade that you see in the Indiana Jones mm-hmm. Last Crusader, and you see this big cut out of the living sandstone wall with columns and figures and whatnot. Well, that was the Roman treasury. It's been modified under Muslim influence for, 1,300 years now.
Yeah, that was a Roman toll booth.
Yes, it was a Roman toll booth with its own cash box that was vast. And that was the one possession, conquest of Trajan that Hadrian kept. And in 142 BC, this is 4 years after Hadrian's death, it got a new governor in that territory, and his name was Lucius Aemilius Carus. Well, that's the one guy that resurfaces in history out of the 9th Roman Legion.
That's the only one.
The only guy that we can find, I found, and a few other folks who've helped me look, mm-hmm. whose name reappears in history, and as a governor. Now, this was a plum post, governor of an entire conquered territory, had some advantages, and he had some political sway. And they had also had a distinction between an imperial territory or senatorial or Roman territory. This one was an imperial, but it had to pay back to Rome in general. So the citizenry and the Senate benefited from it greatly, because it was the Roman toll booth on the Silk Road. Anything that was traded into Asia, basically, was going through their toll booth.
You have to pay on to Caesar what is Caesar's.
Yeah, pretty much. But once you got through that, you were in Rome, even though it's in Syria, and it's in Lebanon today.
Mm-hmm. So we know that they weren't absorbed then. If that one, the one fellow that you've kind of found, we know that they weren't all killed or they weren't all absorbed, because they kept record of all of this, but yet there's a whole legion of men that just went missing.
Well, not just the legion itself, because the camp followers would have been gone too. And the camp followers, they're finding, because even the common soldiers had wives and children that went with them.
Okay. So they traveled. They had a huge group that traveled with them.
Yeah. Probably 15 to 20,000 people total.
And if they were that consumed with trade, as most people were at that time, more than likely there was knowledge of the trade that has gone on over here for hundreds of thousands of years or so, then they would have known about it.
Yeah. Well, they might not have known about it initially, but remember, any place that they actually conquered, the first thing they did was study the history of that place. And when they conquered Carthage, as an example, the city was sown with salt so it would never grow anything. Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't growing anything in the city to begin with. They were growing the weed out there where they actually had water and rainfall and stuff. That wasn't in the city of Carthage. But what they did harvest from the city was all of their history and their libraries and a lot of coinage and a lot of other technologies. And the histories included mentions of mining operations or trade routes to mine operations on the continent. I should say on the European continent, in this case specifically on the Iberian Peninsula, specifically at a place that is called today Rio Tinto, Painted River. Or Red River, okay. Is another interpretation, although that doesn't follow with you know, Castilian Spanish. But Rio Tinto was a mine under Carthage where they mined silver and copper. Then in about 100 BC, you know, about the time Scipio went in, it became a Roman quest to mine that same hole. And they did for probably a couple hundred years, give or take. And then when Rome fell apart, or maybe they just got tired of the ore not being as good, they quit mining it. And then in the very late 19th century, very early 20th century, a British company found out that the Romans had a mine in Rio Tinto 2,000 years ago. And, hey, I wonder if it's still got anything in it. And sure enough, they started producing gold and silver and copper out of it. Oh. And they just closed it down about 6 or 8 years ago.
So is that what they think? Maybe the Ninth Legion was coming over here into Lake Superior, doing any mining over in that part? Could that be part of what it was?
I believe so. I believe it is possible. I don't have direct evidence that they were themselves mining Michigan copper, Superior copper. But I can look at a lot of things that indicate their technologies were used throughout the river systems of Eastern North America. In particular, the line of sight communications thing, because the entire Ohio Valley and all of its tributaries had these stone towers that were almost universally 33 feet tall. And if you go look at the 1840, I believe it was, map of Moundsville, North Carolina, Moundsville, West Virginia, at that time it was just Virginia, you know, where Gray Creek Mound is?
Yes, sir, I've read about it.
There were 15 towers within sight of Great Creek Mound.
So that would be the line of sight communication like the Romans use.
Yeah. And it was a redundant system. You know, if for some reason weather closed off this path, then you could shoot down a different path to get your message out.
And there would be no reason in anybody's mind that a Native American population at all would build a tower, much less have any use for one.
It was documented by antiquarians from the late, middle 1700s up until, late 1800s. And I just got word the other day of three such ruins, not very far from me, that I got to go investigate.
Now, that sounds like fun.
Now, what do mainstream archaeologists claim that these towers are? They claim it's Native American?
Well, it depends on the archaeology. Yes, they claim it's all Native American, definitely.
And that's the only place in the world the Native Americans built a tower. That's insane.
A series of towers.
It doesn't fit anything.
No, it does and it doesn't. Let's go back to that Grave Creek Mound for just a moment. There was one burial in that mound. There were intrusive burials on top, but there was one hyper elite dude that was buried at the bottom middle of that 60-foot tall mound.
Okay.
And he was laying on a bed of mica. You know what mica is,
yes,
right?
Sir.
Okay. Mica used today, in the 20th century, it was used as window material for heaters and whatnot because it could stand the heat and yet you could kind of still see through it, see if your fire was burning. But it is also highly reflective. When you peel a little sheet off of that deposit, it's thin, it's actually somewhat ductile. You can bend it a little bit and it won't break.
And it has a lot, like a shimmer to it.
Yeah. And if you reflect sunlight off of it, then it's mirror-like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of the hyper-elite Adena burials had mica in the grave. And at the bottom of a mound that served as, guess what, a hub for a communications network.
Now, with
the Romans just used brass mirrors.
Did they do? Was the NAGPRA enacted that they didn't get to test any of the DNA on these bones? Were they just reinterred as Native American bones that were found in this mound? Or has anybody looked into it?
When that mound was excavated, neither DNA nor C-14 existed.
Okay.
Well, I mean, as a science, as a tool of science.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened to those remains.
Which is like a lot of remains. They kind of mysteriously go somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll get into that in extent here in a little bit. I guess we could now. The guy that was buried at Grave Creek was fairly tall.
And when you say fairly tall, Rick, what do you mean by fairly tall? I mean, 6 foot's fairly tall.
He would have been small on an NBA team, but he wouldn't have been exceedingly small. He was about a 6.5-footer.
Okay.
And that's not common for the historical tribes. Unless it's Cato down there by you guys. The Catos were 7-footers in historic times. But most of the Easterns were not. And, you know, there's another mound that was just about 30 miles from me. Well, you can still see the site, but you can't really see it in perspective. But there was an 8.5-footer in that one at near Petersburg, Indiana.
And for the listeners, if y'all aren't picking up on this, we're talking about some of the giant remains of the giant race that they know was here in North America.
Well, and they had some other distinctive characteristics besides stature. They were redheaded, almost universally described as redhead. Some of them had hyperdentia. Some of them were polydactyl, meaning they had extra fingers. Mm-hmm. They wore a lot of copper armor in a lot of the different burials and had shell gorgets and copper gorgets and all kinds of ornaments from far-flung places.
Double rows of teeth.
Yeah, the hyperdentia. That one was predominantly in the northern tier states along the edge of the Great Lakes, New York, Ohio, Michigan.
And it seems like in a lot of these burials, too, that they had found like maybe Native American women, like that was their wives or things that they were buried with some of their loved ones.
Yes. The case here close to me, the guy was buried in a coffin that was oak, that was sided or layered with copper sheeting inside and out. And between his legs was a 4.5-foot raven-haired female. And between her legs was an infant. Now, that's according to one. There are two different accounts of this. One of them was in the Western Sun newspaper and out of Vincennes, Indiana. And the other one was a different newspaper, presumably a different writer, but I never did find out who. But that burial was disinterred in 1818. So when they say, okay, and so-and-so was there, well, that particular so-and-so was a real person, and he was the constable, and that so-and-so was the judge or whatever. But these were real people, and they were responsible people.
Uh-huh.
So it wasn't, you know, something just to sell newspapers.
And if you follow the lines of like with the Native Americans, I know that a lot of their belief system was in order to be kind of accepted in their tribe, you had to marry into their tribe.
Yeah.
And so that kind of leads a little more credence to the fact that these men may have been married into their tribe.
Yeah. But you go out west, for instance, the Lovelock Giants, and a few other tales nearby. Comparatively nearby, the natives were tired of being prey for these giant folks, you know, and their cannibalism. So they rounded them up and pushed them in a cave and then smoked them to death. And a couple of those mummies have come to light just within the last century, even though the tale was known for 300 years. At the other extreme, in Utah, there was a body pulled from a cave on an artificial wall walling off part of this cave. And this individual, if he was stretched out, was 19 inches tall. He was fully adult, and there are still x-rays of the body. It's not a doll or an art project. This is a tiny person.
And that's what I think gets most people is there's a lot of people have listened and read about the giants and got into all that. And, you know, and it's one of those things that when you start really digging into the remains of the giants, it becomes completely obvious that somewhere there was a full blown cover up, be it involving, if you want to say the Smithsonian, we know was involved. There's a lot of people involved with not allowing this stuff to get out. They just didn't talk about it. It's getting to be more and more freely known. And like you said, these people that had found it and reported on it. It wasn't just some old boy that was an old farmer just talked about that's what he saw and then he covered the bones back up. I mean, you made it a really good point to say that it was some very respectable people in the community, but not a lot of people know about the small people that were also found in North America.
Right. In just about every portion of North America. But the most telling part of that for me is the native names for these small people. In the Great Lakes states and territories and provinces, if you're on the Canadian side, they are Pukwudgeni. That's what they call them. The little trickster is kind of a rough translation depending on which language that tribe speaks. But in New England, they're Pukwudgies. And even down into North Carolina, North and South Carolina, they're still called Pukwudgeni, or it's got a little different inflection, but it's the same word.
And where all have they found these remains?
The most reliable accounts are in Middle Tennessee and extreme southern Ohio.
So it's more than one body that was found. I mean, it wasn't just an anomaly with like maybe a dwarf or something.
Okay, I'll paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, but the account from Middle Tennessee estimated 7,000 graves.
Whoa. Yeah, I've never heard of that.
No, it wasn't a one-off.
Yeah. And it wasn't 7,000 children. Let's make sure that they know that, too.
Well, it was not, but that's what the Smithsonian put out initially. And then 130 years later, a little-known guy by the name of Barry Fell, who was somebody who had the credentials to actually get in there at that time, went to the Smithsonian into the ossuary bins, and somehow he had the bin numbers to go look for those skeletons. And eventually I'll get to see his notes on that, I hope. But he said that, no, they had arthritis. They had, you know, teeth that were aged and ground down to nubs. And they had multiple fractures that had healed, some of them quite badly. But no, these were not children. These were not 7 years old.
Yeah, you can date them by I think, their teeth, because they know that children don't have the, you know, the advanced molars that adults have.
Right, among other things. But they also, he noted a different look to the skull sutures. Hold on. If that's pervasive, then that's a different species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just little humans, it's different humans.
Well, with the 7,000 that they found, were they all, was this like a burial site or was it like a mass murder? Like they went through and killed thousands of these things?
That's an interesting question. And there, if he said that the skulls, for the most part, were in good shape, so they weren't bashed in the head. And he couldn't, of course, he wasn't looking at them in situ, so he didn't know the condition in the hole. Mm-hmm. And they didn't dig up all 7,000. They did dig up hundreds, however, and estimated the full burying ground at 7,000.
Wow. Now, when was all these found?
Date-wise, I want to say it was 1856 on that one, but I would have to go research it to be sure.
So it's beginning to be right around the same time as they went to really finding more and more from, because it seems like from the 1840s and 50s up until the late 1800s to right at 1900, it seems like that's whenever it was the heyday of finding all these remains, and they were doing their best to sweep it under the rug. Just everybody don't pay any attention to this.
By 1880s, they were sweeping it under the rug actively. And not only were they sweeping it under the rug, they were warning people not to even talk about it in a very roundabout way, but that was the warning. If you talk about it, you won't get published here.
And they have the, like you said, they have the case files and the research numbers. They have all this stuff, and it's still there today, but the Smithsonian is like, we don't know what you're talking about. I mean, we've heard numerous of these stories that they're like, we have all the information you would be able to need to go back into any of your case files and find it. And still the people in the Smithsonian today are like, we have no idea what you're talking about.
And they don't. The people who are working there today have no idea because no one's looked into it for 100 years. And then Barry Fell somehow got a hold of those bin numbers and he was able to walk right to them.
And how recent was this?
Well, Barry died in what, 96, I think. So at least before his death.
So at least in the 80s, mid 80s to late 80s, we'd say.
Mid 80s to mid 90s would be my guess.
Huh. That is, it's a stunning thing to know that we've got this kind of stuff that we could easily, with the technology that we have today, study these and really find out what it was, really be able to do a lot of study into it. But yet it's still one of those things. It's like, shh, we don't know what y'all are talking about.
Yeah.
Right. What are they afraid of?
Well, yeah.
I could guess a couple things. Let's start with, okay, let's say we got a hold of one of those skeletons and we start looking at the wrist. Is that the same wrist setup as Homo floresiensis? Mm-hmm. Is it the hobbits? And if so, how the hell did they get to North America?
Exactly. How did they get all the way over here? And then how did they bloom? I mean, you know, you're talking about what they found on that island. And how did we get so many? If there was 7,000 of them that they estimate was in that burial area, how many of them were really alive? That,
well, there must have been a city. I mean, a whole civilization.
A civilization there. Of these things.
Well, there was certainly a population. And interestingly enough, most of them were buried standing up.
Well, that's strange.
It is strange.
Well, it's really not. I mean, it's a shallow hole.
Right. You didn't have to dig it real deep because, you know.
You don't have to get down below the freeze line.
Barely. But, yeah, and they did not report any artifacts with any of those bodies.
So, which would make sense because if it's anything like the hobbits, they were almost like very primitive small creatures.
And yet those hobbits made stone tools and hunted pygmy elephants.
And people have to realize that they know those remains were just no older than, what, 18,000 years ago?
13,000.
13. So there's a very good chance that they could have been some, could have been taken off the island by somebody, maybe. The speculation could run wild from that point. But if we have the remains here, it would be nice to be able to, like you said, to be able to put them up against the hobbit remains and see if they are remotely similar in any way.
Yeah, that comparative physiology. But we'll probably never get that chance. But it sure is a cool question to think about. And as an extension to that question, if I were going to mine copper in, say, Upper Michigan, and that seam was, 18 inches tall, then I can't get in it on my hands and knees, but somebody who was 3 feet tall could.
You could just stroll right in.
Well, I couldn't stroll in. It'd still have to be on their hands and knees, but at least they could get in it.
Mm-hmm.
I could not.
I guess the thing that always floors me the most is the more that we've researched and looked into this history is that it feels like there truly was and still is in some form, some sort of active ongoing cover up that they just don't want to discuss. They just don't want to talk about it. When I say they, I mean, it could be any form of anybody. It just feels like there's somebody out there or the multiples or something knows so much more about it. Like I always felt like the Repatriation Act almost feels like it was done. They made it seem like they were doing it for all the right reasons, when in reality that was kind of like it was a kill two birds with one stone. We can make these people happy, but we can also make sure these remains get stuck back in the ground so fast before anybody gets a chance to take a look at them.
That's starting to backfire on them just a little bit. Well, of course, Kennewick Man.
Yes.
Was a huge deal there, 9,400 years old and looking very Caucasian.
Well, can you tell the listeners about that before we get to go and do? Let them know if they haven't heard of that. It's a great story.
Yeah, if you have not heard of Kennewick Man, let me introduce you to Google because you need to know this story. I'll give you the highlights. A guy by the name of Jim Chatters, who was an a forensic anthropologist, meaning he studied old bones and old tools and artifacts for a living, and he was called into the case when a couple of guys trying to sneak into a boat race discovered a skull or some bones, human bones, and he was called in to help collect those bones with along with the sheriff's department and then try to figure out where they came from, who they were, because he and the sheriff thought it looked like a white guy and they pursued it that way, except that during the investigation they found a lithic point, a projectile point embedded in this guy's pelvis that did not kill him. He lived for decades afterwards.
And that sounds terrible in itself.
It does. But and then later study far down the road indicates that he was ritually buried on a riverbank there. He didn't just fall there, which kind of helps explain the very, very good state of preservation for bones that old. Anyway, they ran a carbon 14 after they figured out there was a point in him, and they came up with, you know, 9,400 years before present. Hold on. What's this Caucasian guy doing here in Washington State, you know, 9,400 years ago?
That slightly rocks the boat.
And that is when the excrement hit the air movement device. Because the federal government and the tribes jumped in and said, oh, no, you can't have him if he's that old. He's ours. It's like, actually, no, he's not. And it went to court, and Jim Chatters was party to the suit. Dennis Stanford of the Smithsonian was party to the suit, and that's probably why he can't get published today. A few other very influential scientists in this general realm, seven of them altogether, sued and got the finding and got the right judge and the right lawyer to run the case. And the judge interpreted the law as it was written. Any tribe that can show a relationship to the remains can claim those remains and rebury them in some secret location where you'll never get to test them again. And the judge said, so how are you going to prove your relationship? And the tribes are at a loss because it was so long ago, and they don't even, you know, nobody's going to let the scientific side run DNA. They're not going to let that happen because it might not come back to suit them.
Yeah.
And the DNA test that was run came back as Caucasian. Oh, well, that's contaminated. That can't be right because he's got to be Native American. Well, the judge said, I don't see that you really have a case here, the five tribes and the U.S. government, but here's what we'll do. We'll take this skeleton and we'll put it in the custody of the National Science Foundation and house it there at one of the universities in Washington, and we'll have the National Science Foundation go check on it every year to make sure it's in good shape, being curated, preserved in the best possible fashion. And that's where it stands today, what, 12 years later. And there's been no science done with this skeleton. These remains still are effectively unstudied. And that's just a crime, in my opinion.
Completely. Yeah. I mean, it's that could unlock so many things, and yet it's just at a stalemate for the last 12 years. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And yes, it's being preserved and it's being honored as, oh, okay, whoever this dude was, somebody 9,000 years ago thought enough of him to give him a nice ritual burial. So, you know, he deserves our respect as well. But our respect is also, who the hell were you, dude?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, I mean, that's the things that I can't ever wrap my head around is the fact that why don't more people just go, let's go ahead and test it. You know, I mean, we've done all these other things. Let's just test it. You know, we're not going to be disrespectful. It's not going to be disgraceful in any sort. We just want to test it and find out. And like you said, if it comes back with some DNA or some kind of evidence that it actually has the lineage of a Native American tribe and we know which tribe it is, then here it is. It's yours. But if
or
it comes
not Native American, yeah,
exactly.
It could be Polynesian or Ainu. Japanese, he could be
exactly.
He could be anybody, but that nose sure looks European.
Yeah, but and they seem like they want to. Yeah, they seem like they want to run from it. I mean, we had spoken to Scott Walter, and he was talking about them trying to get the DNA tested for the jawbone remains that was found with the Bat Creek Stone.
Yeah,
because they want to know. They're like, well, we want to know if it's truly Native American or if it's a Caucasian, if it's some sort of Hebrew descent. And there's so many questions out there that could answer.
Anomalous. Yeah. Well, it can also lead to a lot more questions, and that's what they don't want to deal with.
You think? Do you think, I wonder why. I mean, like, why is it? Why are they so against finding out the true settlers of this land? I mean, I know you don't know personally, but I mean, it just seems like the
I can surmise a very plausible against answer to that question, and it goes like this: all of the land claims of the United States, whether it's through the French or the English or the Spanish, all go back to Columbus's claim of discovery for, well, he never made it to North America. He was in the West Indies, but nevertheless, it all goes back to that. And his claim and the Spanish claim go back 40-odd years before that, 1452, to a papal bull entitled Terra Nullius, meaning literally Latin for empty land. And what it breaks down to, and thank you, Roger J. Miller, who teaches law at Lewis and Clark University in Oregon, a Native American himself, the doctrine of discovery comes from this Terra Nullius. And Terra Nullius basically said to the conquistadors and crusaders, if there ever were any more after 1452, if you enter a land where there are no Christians, well, whoever is there doesn't count because they're not Christians, and they can't own the land because they're not Christians. And you can claim the land and you can enslave or kill anybody that's there if they're not Christians.
I gotcha. So we can, that can really cause a problem. Really get into it.
Yeah, I can say that.
So if there were Christians in North America before Columbus, then his claim is null and void. And his claim is a seminal claim for, well, the United States as we know it today, and Canada as we know it today, which brings up an even more enormous conundrum for Canada, because we now know that Norse, you can call them Vikings if you want, but that's not completely accurate, Norse settlers were at Lonzo Meadows about 998 to about 1006 in Canada. And the people who discovered that, a husband and wife team, fought for 35 years to get recognition that it was even Norse, let alone that it was a colony. And now we know that they had, first biggest giveaway, they had spindle whorls. Okay, let's go to the others first. They had ship's nails, and they had a blacksmith shop, and they had all this stuff that said, okay, maybe they repaired ships. But they had spindle whorls. That means they were making yarn. That means they had something to get wool from. It may have been sheep. It may have been musk ox. It could have been bison. I don't know. But we'll come back to the bison. And the men did not spin wool. So they had women. Therefore, it was a full-blown colony. Mm-hmm. And they had enough housing for a couple hundred people. And we have a saga, a written record, written down in 1156, I think it was. Granted, that's 160 years after the event. But nevertheless, it's a written history, written by Snorri Snorrason in Iceland, of Leif's saga, where he founded a colony in Vinland. Well, Leif's mission from the King of Norway was not to go to North America. His mission was to go to Greenland and convert them, or reconvert them, to Christianity. So, whoops, wait a minute. We know there were Christians in North America.
Oh, well. And they just, if they keep going back, it changes, like you said, it just keeps changing everything.
Yeah, if they allow one to get through, then all questions are on the table.
Yeah. It's so aggravating because there's so much information, and the work like you've done and everyone else, that these guys in history have really put in the work to unearth all this stuff. And it still seems like nobody wants to hear it. And and our listeners and the public, people are fascinated with it. I mean, it's getting to be more and more popular on television. There's more and more shows about it. And it's almost like it's sooner or later, probably a little later, something's going to have to be done. The clamor is going to get too loud. It's going to have to be where there's going to be some child or some young man listening now or watching television is going to be the guy that becomes totally obsessed and dedicates his life to it. And maybe he's the one.
Some rogue scientist.
Yeah, he gets it pushed through.
Well, that's another. I have a chapter in my book that the chapter is entitled "The Failure of Science," and that's what it is. Right now, it is an absolute failure, epic fail on calling archaeology science. And incidentally, a number of famous would be an apt word. Archaeologists or retired archaeologists agree it is not a hard science. This is a social science. We don't even want to talk about weapons of war. We want to talk about how they made fabric, grew food, and you know, made homes. And that's all important. I'm not decrying that. It is important. But if they had weapons that were not specifically designed for hunting, who the hell were they fighting so desperately that they made tens of thousands of these points? And they did. And they had badges of honor, and they had systems of writing, and they had, you know, communication systems, and they had long distance trade, because you find conch shells along the shores of Superior, and you find Superior copper along the shore of the Gulf of Mexico, particularly Poverty Point, which was on the shore of the Gulf of Mexico 2,000 years ago, and is now 75 miles from the sea, because we've been plying for 250 years. And all the mud had to go someplace. But Poverty Point, they had not only trade copper, they also had copper smithing facilities, and they had some 4 million little clay balls, many of them with faces impressed or somehow decorated these clay balls, baked clay, 4 million of them. They didn't do that overnight.
No, that's not a real quick fix right there. That's not something just a bunch of people sit around and get on their Pinterest and sit there and punch that up. That's something that takes a little more work.
Poverty Point had metalworking facilities way beyond just handling raw copper. And they had smelting facilities, because you can still see the where the soil is burned, in fact, melted. That was a hot fire.
Yeah.
You can also see where the Mississippi River is cut off about a third of the entire complex, which at one time basically consisted of 7 concentric rings. Wait a minute. What? How, tell me again how Plato described Atlantis. I believe it was 7 concentric rings.
I believe you're right.
And canals. And that's not the only example of that setup either. There's a very similar one in South Central Florida, way out in Okeechobee. It had its own system of canals, hundreds of miles of canals. Southern Louisiana, not the coast as it is today, but the coast as it was a couple hundred years ago, had hundreds of miles of canals. Some of them two-lane, 100 feet wide, 20 feet deep. Whatever was moving on those was large.
There's just so much evidence here. From all over. I mean, it's one of those things that we, I mean, even as when I was still in school, you're taught one way, that there was really not much going on here prior to Columbus landing, and then the things started happening. But that was really not true. There was so much going on here. It's like we're still getting a grasp of it. I mean, even the things we're finding now, we're still piecing everything together. It keeps snowballing. It's like it started small, and they're trying to hide it, but it just gets out of control.
Sometimes something gets through, yeah. Grave Creek stone, as an example. I talked about Grave Creek earlier, but Grave Creek not only had a large body and a bunch of mica, it had a little tablet, about an inch and an eighth by an inch and a half, give or take. And it had an inscription on it. Can't find that original stone today. It's lost. But there's a pretty good copy on display at the museum there. And if you back away from it and you're not trying to actually read it, what you see is the outline of Northern Africa and Western Europe and North America, and a line going from basically Cadiz, Spain to Grave Creek.
Like a carved map.
Yes.
Wow.
It's like that person wasn't born at Grave Creek. It's where he ended up. And that was, I believe that was under his skull.
And
much like the Bat Creek stone.
Strangely, that little stone vanished.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's strange, isn't it? Well, it's sure is strange how things like that have a way of vanishing.
Yeah. Coshocton, Ohio has some strange stuff, too. In fact, that's where one of the pygmy burial grounds was. But the Humerkaus Museum has some swords. I think they're all later, but the person who donated them thought they were very early because of the depth he found them. But I think they're all later reproductions. It also has some other, this would be in the class of lithic evidence, stones that are engraved, and just Hebrew or Paleo-Hebrew or pre-Hebrew something, characters, as well as, well, you know, there's a Decalogue stone. You know about that
one? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
A piece of stone that has the Ten Commandments in a slightly different alphabet, and a figure that may be Moses is almost certainly Moses. And it's on inside its own little stone box, carved stone box. And it was sealed when it was found, probably with lead, but it was sealed nonetheless. And that one's controversial a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But there are hundreds, not dozens, hundreds of such artifacts that are, quote, out-of-place artifacts. There's a fairly new group on Facebook. I just came across them the other day. It's called, I believe it's Open-Minded Archaeologists. And they had me when I read their banner. There are no out-of-place artifacts, only out-of-date theories.
That's perfect.
That's what I thought.
That is perfect. It can't be summed up any better than that.
Yeah.
The evidence is whatever the evidence is. You can't change the evidence, although they certainly try to ignore it. In fact, there was a Columbus Dispatch just the other day. Let's see. It was actually dated today, but the E edition came out yesterday. A story by Dean Narciso, and it's an interview with Bill Pickard, the Ohio Historical Society's assistant curator. And also there's a comment by Brad Lepper, who is their guy. But down towards the end of the article, he says, I've always said that carbon dating is like free shoes. If the dates fit, you keep them. If they don't, you get rid of them. What?
How can you even say that?
That's openly saying we pick and choose the data to support our theory.
Yeah, that's exactly
what it means.
Then there's no reason to even date it. Why waste your time? You're just like, I'm not going to believe that no matter what it is. So,
yeah.
And it seems like that's been a trend among some of the scientists. I don't know as much as recent, but I know some of the past history has shown that some of the scientists have been down that road, have really shown some of those things that they just don't, if it doesn't fit what they believe and it doesn't squeeze inside their little box, then they don't care anything about it. They don't want to acknowledge it. It doesn't matter how strong the evidence is. They don't care.
Agreed.
And that's not a scientific way. That's not scientific method. There's no way is that even real science. It's impossible.
Right, but they're not real scientists.
Exactly.
They're social engineers.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote out of Frank Joseph's newest book, The Lost Colonies of Ancient America. He said in there that there was a Dr. Michael Waters from Texas A&M University in 1929, and he pretty much said that, I don't care what the evidence is, I can't believe the old dates because they refute everything that is known about archaeology and anthropology. I could never bring myself to believe those old dates. So, I mean, it doesn't matter what evidence you bring forth. If it doesn't fit their paradigm, they don't believe it.
And they're still being trained in that fashion, too. So until you change their training, nobody's going to open their eyes what's out there. It's got to start somewhere. It has to change somewhere before anybody starts really opening their mind. I feel bad for the guys that's dedicated their lives to it.
And then whenever they get out or they're done with their stuff and they can really start looking at things, they're like, man, I may have made a mistake, but, you know, I can't go back after 40 years of dedicating my life to it and say I made a mistake. I'm not about to do that.
Yeah. Well, if you've been at it for 40 years and got it wrong all the time, I wouldn't admit the mistake either.
Yeah, you're probably right. Rick, what do you have coming up? Do you have any lectures? What have you got going on with us?
Planning a short book tour to Utah, Wyoming, and possibly in Nebraska, a couple stops in Nebraska in April. Don't have anything hard dates yet, but it will be sometime in the Provo, Utah area in April. And I'm writing for Ancient American Magazine.
That is a great magazine.
Expanding on the theme in my book, The Graves of the Golden Bear, and examining the fortresses and the signal towers all along the Ohio. So this, you know, this series could go a long time.
Exactly. Yeah. Now the book, The Graves of the Golden Bear, where is the best place for everybody to find it? Can they get it direct from you or do they just go Amazon? How's the best way for them to get it?
If they want it signed, they'll have to either meet up with me someplace or we'll have to make other arrangements. But if they want it in any other fashion, it's on Amazon as both Kindle and print, paperback. In fact, I think there's a little drop in the Kindle price right now. There are even used ones on Amazon print. It's also Barnes & Noble. You can get it in a Nook format, or you can get an order in print from Barnes. You can order it in print from Books Million. It's in e-edition for Diesel and Smashwords and Sony eBooks and I think Google Books, maybe. I'm not certain about that one. Several of them. And the publisher, you can get it direct from the publisher, which is Grave Distractions Publications. That's not me, incidentally. Brian Nard. Just so happened that it came together. His book is about grave robbers, his first book. It's also available through Ancient American. Well, it will be in a couple of days. Right now, he's out.
If, so, if somebody's selling their book back to have it used on, yeah, on Amazon, I mean, they're to be horsewhipped. Once you get the book,
probably an archaeologist.
Yeah, exactly. A son of a gun. Well, where can people find you? I mean, I know you've got a website. Do you have a YouTube pay or channel and all that?
Yes. Just Google Rick Osmond on YouTube or Oopa Loopa Cafe on YouTube, and you'll certainly find a few dozen, as you guys have.
Yeah.
actually, a couple hundred, I think. But yeah, I have the Graves of Golden Bear has its own Facebook page, and so do I. And soon, around March the 1st, there will be a new website called ancientamerica.com. That's not ancientamericanmagazine.com, but we are going to be working with Wayne to some degree. It's myself and a couple other folks, one of whom is a professor emeritus retired from the University of Wisconsin, Jim Schurz, and prolific researcher in his own right, and very down to earth, very scientific method oriented. And he had never been in my neck of the woods to any extent. And then middle of last summer, I got him here for a couple of days and we cruised around southern Indiana and on down into southeastern Kentucky and saw some things that he had never seen firsthand. Most of them he knew about, but had never seen firsthand. So we're going to be working together a little more closely from now on.
If you say he's a good researcher, I can't even imagine.
Oh, man. I'm telling you.
I mean, this is coming from a master researcher.
Well, I appreciate that. But so is Jim. I mean, certainly. And he taught surveying at the University of Wisconsin. So his main area of regard, so to speak, is the mounds and their layout, because they didn't just throw one up. They threw them up as a system in many cases, most cases, in fact. I'm not talking about burial mounds so much, although there are a few that fit the paradigm. I'm talking about basically signal mounds and other quote unquote ceremonial sites. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much so ceremonial as it was utilitarian. That's what we're discovering. And it was multi-purpose, multitasking site. It was signaling and astronomy, and we don't know what all they did with mathematics, but they were pretty sophisticated at it.
It seems like they were very, very handy at the mathematics with it.
Yeah.
There's so much more information. I mean, it's got to be a trilogy of books you're fixing to come out with, if not more. It seems like they're just going to keep rolling out.
Well, if I can ever finish some of them. Yeah, I got two in the works right now. One of them is actually about the hollow earth theory. Okay, that's just part of it. It's, pardon the pun, but it's the core.
We're going to definitely have to get you back on for that.
Yeah.
And another one about ancient, basically navigation means, methods, techniques, technologies, and the mathematics that they had to have to support it, and when that was developed, by whom and where, because that's all available. Just historians tend to ignore it. They call Euclid the father of geometry, right?
Okay.
Well, how would you have Pythagoras' theorem 300 years before Euclid if he invented geometry?
Good point.
Good point.
So, you know, it's just those holes in the conventional story.
Do you ever sleep, Rick? I mean, there's so much work you're doing. Do you ever sleep?
I sleep fitfully at times. But yeah, I do. I didn't for years, actually.
It's like you got to have clones of yourself running around doing all this.
No, but I do have a lot of really good people who are willing to help. And I give them credit where credit is due, as much as I possibly can. As you've heard throughout this show, if somebody contributed something that was a major breakthrough for me, or even a minor point, but it was theirs, then yeah, it's theirs. It's not mine.
You got to have a good team.
Yeah. I'll use it, but yeah. I'll let everybody know that somebody else came up with it. And that's the way it should be. And that's the one thing that they almost do right in archaeology, conventional archaeology. They cite their sources, but they pick and choose their sources too.
That's true. Well, we've had a wonderful night. Yes. Thank you so much. We're going to wrap all this up. We don't get off air. Don't leave just yet. We want to talk to you off air. But when you get finished with those books, we'd like for you to come back every chance you get.
Okay, that's a deal.
I mean, the Hollow Earth thing is something that I'm just like, man, I had...
I've even seen some of the maps of Hollow Earth.
It's crazy, yeah. I mean, with the whole thing, we could get started on that. We could go for hours talking about, was this Admiral Byrd and then some of his... I mean, we could go into hours about that stuff, too. But we don't want to keep you later than we have to. We had a wonderful time. We're going to put all your stuff in the show notes. Make sure everybody finds it, folks.
Everybody get out and buy the book, you Graves of the Golden Bear.
You got to get it. And if you can, go catch him in one of his book signings. Get the book straight from Rick. It'd be great.
Cool.
It would
guys,
be
guys, thank you. Thank you so much.
We've had a blast. It's been our pleasure.
It's guys like you that, I mean, keep informing the public about this, the history and everything. And, you know, we really appreciate all the hard work you've done.
Well, I appreciate you helping me get the word out.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview, folks. Very interesting conversation. That's about all the time we have for this episode of Expanded Perspectives from the Archives. Stay tuned for the next one. The next one, we're going to be talking to David Weatherly about some unusual encounters. Till then, be safe. I'm Kyle Filson. Peace.